Welcome to Endnotes. My name is Sheila Broderick. In this programme, we invite people to share their funeral playlist and their thoughts about death, dying, ritual and the afterlife if they believe in one. Today, my guest is Justin Grounds, a violinist, composer and electronic music producer based in West Cork. He studied Baroque violin with Rachel Good in his hometown of Cambridge and went on to do a degree in music and theology at Durham University, majoring in electroacoustic composition. Justin toured as violinist with the live electronic band Keiretsu, as well as producing 5 albums of solo music. He most recently collaborated with songwriter Pierce McLaughlin on Idiot Songs, an acclaimed collection of electronic chamber songs taking inspiration from Dostoevsky. His work for orchestra and chamber ensembles has been celebrated for its minimalist musical aesthetic, with an almost rhapsodic arch of movement. His Passa Caglia Apis for solo Baroque violin and string orchestra won the inaugural East Cork Early Music Festival Composers Competition in 2014 and was premiered by Maya Humberger and Barry Guy. He performs regularly as a solo Baroque violinist, as a composing member of the Vespertine Quintet, leader of the chamber group The Early Modern Players, and with bands Idiot Songs, Fir Bjug and Farewell JR. He also works as a record producer and string arranger, teaches workshops with young people, and is a member of the Arts for Health team, bringing music to hospital and clinical environments. You're very welcome, Justin.
Thank you.
Did it take you a lot of effort to prepare for this interview, to start thinking about death and dying?
Well, you gave me a good bit of time, or did I tally somewhat? But I did spend quite a lot of time thinking about it, and it wasn't a lot of effort, but it was something that maybe took a little bit more space in the front of my mind that would have been in the back of my mind more. I suppose I've thought a lot about death and dying, but I haven't thought about my funeral. And so the invitation to make a playlist was quite charming and quite inspiring, actually. And it got me back to thinking about all the sort of music that has moved me or I've been involved with, or... You know, there's so much music in my life that I've been involved with, probably more than most people. So there was a lot to go through. And then to the point, then to the kind of idea of, well, you know, with all this music, which ones would I choose for the funeral? Because the funeral's really for the people I'm leaving behind, because I'm already gone. So what do I want to leave them with? That was the question that fascinated me. And it got me to start thinking in a new, maybe not in a new way, but maybe in a deeper way about what does music mean to me and why am I doing it, actually. So it actually was, yeah, it wasn't a lot of effort, but it was a great question and a great invitation.
Well, I'm glad you accepted
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
And I suppose the history of music has, to a large extent, been a history of funeral ritual.
Sure.
With composers being commissioned to do major works. But your chosen music is mostly modern. And I'm just wondering, did you consider older music? Because you're known for an awful lot for older music.
Yeah, in fact, I was just having lunch with a friend and I was telling him about coming here to do this. He said, it'll all be from the 17th century. And I said, no, not at all. But actually, funny enough, when I was really young, I was a terror of a child. I was the second child of the family and I was a terror. And the only time I stopped screaming was when they put me in front of the violins in the music shop when I was about 3 years old. So they got me a violin at age 4. And then when I was 6, somehow I'd been playing, you know, bits and bobs. Somehow I heard some story, some news that the Philharmonic Orchestra were coming to town and they were going to do Mozart Requiem. And I didn't even know anything about Requiems or what it means or anything, but for some reason I was insistent on going, and I badgered my mum to buy me my 7th birthday present, a ticket to Mozart Requiem, and she went ahead and did it. And I still remember vividly, I'm almost there again, a 7-year-old. I think it was in Trinity College Chapel in Cambridge, and you know, going into the hush of the chapel and the lights are on and I could hear the buzz of the instruments warming up, and I was like the youngest there by far, and all these people coming up to my parents saying, are you sure it's quite a long piece, you know, are you sure? And I remember from the very first, when the bassoon and the oboe come in at the beginning, I was just mesmerized by it. And since then in my life, I've actually had many opportunities to sing in Mozart Requiem and then to play in Mozart Requiem. And I sort of feel probably I'll have to conduct it before I die. So I'm holding off that. But so that was a really special piece to me. And it's a piece about death. And I mean, Mozart died when he was halfway through writing it, which makes it even more powerful. And I was going to start with something from Mozart Requiem, but it is quite dark. The opening is quite dark. And I didn't want to leave people only with sort of dark, you know. So I felt, you know, maybe that was just special to me, that music, but this is also thinking about the people I love and the people I'm leaving behind, what to leave them. So I sort of chose not to put that one in.
Yeah, because some of them
profoundly
are
beautiful
and intense.
They are quite intense, and they also do have a sort of, many of them, that 17th century theology of, like, you know, you're going to be judged and God is this, you know. I mean, which in some respects is worth taking in one way, the symbolism, seriously. But in another respect, for me, I don't want to leave people with that idea. So, so I chose Against a Requiem. But we do have the St. Matthew Passion in there from Bach, the Aus Liebe. So there is something from the 17th century. But I mean, to me, I mean, you know, I've always felt that music should only ever be categorized by alphabetical order. Do you know, I've always felt like that. You know, people come up with all these genres and what sort of music's that and what sort of music's that. Well, it's just music. And it doesn't matter what era it came from, when it was written. If it has, you know, if it has a deep sort of, a deep connection with what it means to be human, or a deep resonance is probably the best word, with being alive, then it's good music. Do you know? So it doesn't, I don't really think about eras. I mean, I play a lot of music from the Baroque era, basically just because I find that such vital and vibrant music and great fun to play. So, yeah.
And I suppose you bring up an interesting point that the music at a funeral is a consolation. Like, there is a cathartic element,
yeah, sure,
to the music.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's interesting to think I won't be there. Well, I will be there, but it'll just be my remains, you know, probably.
And your compositions.
And my work will be there. So what do I really want to leave people with? And I did get really strong feeling that I want, you know, for me, all through my life, even since being a very small child, music has been sort of a deep sense of comfort and healing in the sort of wider sense. And it's energizing and it's full of life. And it's something, one of the very few things I've found that is able to deal with darkness and light. It's able to deal with sadness, but not leave you just feeling completely sad, isn't it? Something about music transforms the sadness and makes it sort of healing. Yeah, I think I really wanted to leave people with that sense.
And can you introduce one of the songs from your funeral playlist?
Let's listen to Arvo Pärt's My Heart is in the Highlands.
And why did you choose that song?
Arvo Pärt's an Estonian composer. He's very popular now, but he's very special to me because his process of finding music and creating music is so authentic and so deeply human, so deeply sort of looking for the perfect resonance, to the point where he actually didn't write any music for about 10 years because he was so deeply trying to find the right way of himself doing it. And the story he tells is that after about 8 years of not creating anything, he went down to get the tram outside his apartment. It was snowy on the ground and the janitor was sweeping, and he, as he waited for the tram, he asked the janitor, "Excuse me, sir, but could I ask you your advice?" He says, "Yeah." He says, "How should a composer write music?" And the janitor says to him, "Interesting question." He said, "I think he should love every note. And Arvo Pärt says that very sentence sparked him, and now he's maybe had 40 years of highly celebrated and profound work. I was lucky enough that he came to Durham when I was there, although I never got to meet him, but he was bustling around the Department of Music and we performed some of his work, and I've been performing ever since, and it's quite special to me. And My Heart is in the Highlands, I just felt it's taken the lines of a Robert Burns poem. There's such simplicity in the music, just the organ and the vocal is just on one note, and then the third note, and then the fifth note of the triad. Such space in the music, which is really important to me. And then the sentiment of the words, "My heart is in the highlands," I always felt was chasing the deer. My heart is not here. I kind of feel very kindred to that, because since I was very young, my heart's been trying to get up to those high places and trying to get to those transcendent experiences. I'm always longing. I'm a person of great longing for those things. So I just thought that summed it up well.
Justin, you were talking there about transcendence and music. Can you say a little bit more about that? Does that reflect your own cosmology about what happens after you die?
Yeah, it's a big question, but it's a good one. I was thinking about this on my bike on the way down because, yeah, it's always interesting thinking about where these ideas or where our worldview, our cosmology is born, and I feel it's something that's sort of constantly evolving. And I always get quite frustrated with people who sort of just go into religion and then that's it. They're sort of in, they don't ever evolve their ideas of it, you know. And I was brought up in sort of intellectual Catholic home in Cambridge, where both my parents were Catholics, but my dad's a astrophysicist. And every Sunday we went to Mass at the Dominican Priory in Cambridge, where as a kid I would have heard all kinds of pretty amazing sermons being preached, whether or not I took any of it in. So I suppose I was, for me as a kid, having a sort of faith structure or religion structure was quite normal, but also being able to talk about it intellectually was really normal too. So it was quite nice. But as a kid, I remember going to the Easter Vigil on the Saturday night in the garden, and they would light a big bonfire, and everyone would have a little candle. And I remember I couldn't wait to get there as a kid, you know. And the fire represented this light in the darkness, and then we would all, the priest would take the light on his candle, and then he'd light someone else, and the flame would gradually spread until the whole garden was full of light, and then we'd sort of process into the church. And those elements of religion I found fascinating, I found the mysticism and the symbolism of it almost like an art. It's almost like doing a dance, isn't it? I found all that really, really enriching as a kid even, and I didn't probably understand why we were doing it. It took hold of me, and it still does in a way, and I still have a great sort of respect for ritual, even the way we put on concerts or the way we, you know, structure simple everyday things. There's a really important part that ritual plays because it helps us symbolize deeper things that we can't really do in other ways. And I suppose as I was growing up, music was always the thing that, like, that was the place I always found transcendence, if that's the right word for it. When I was performing music, I would have these very deep experiences of sometimes even coming out of my body and watching my fingers go and then going, oh my goodness, I should be concentrating here, you know. But, you know, I suppose you reach that point where your body's just flowing through it, but there's this incredible resonance happening. And if I look back on it now, that was where I found transcendence. That's still where I find it. I still hold on to tenets of the Christian story. There's still parts of it that I'm very enamored by, but I don't really subscribe. I don't go to Mass. I don't really subscribe to any religion, but I hold very deeply elements of the religion. I suppose why I went to Durham to do theology and music was because I wanted to kind of get a grip on why I got this transcendence, why I felt so deeply alive when I was playing music more than anything else. So yeah, transcendence is a big part of it for me, and it's something that I suppose I'm aiming for. I don't know if you can ever fully achieve it, but it's certainly something to aim for.
And yeah. One of your lecturers at Durham had he to have specific studies around death and dying.
Yes, Professor Douglas Davies, he was my supervisor of my thesis and a great friend. He, in fact, I ended up meeting him in California one time, and we drove around the Joshua Tree desert together in an old beat up car, he was telling me that the cactuses were all moving somewhere. That he was a fascinating man, he still is, and a very lovely man. His whole area of study was anthropology of religion, and he did death, ritual and belief. Yeah, so that was a part of it.
And I know there was on one occasion a film crew visited, isn't that right? And he took a trip around a graveyard?
Yeah, he told me all about this because right near where I grew up was the first ever sort of official woodland burial site in England. It was about a mile away from where I grew up. I used to go on my bike past it all the time. And so that was getting started. And he ended up doing a lot of work with it, being sort of one of the world experts on this stuff. And he ended up being asked to walk around it with Richard Dawkins, of all people, and quiz him about his funeral, I think it ended up being. So, yeah. Yeah.
Great. And can you introduce your next song?
Yeah, well, we should, I think, listen now to Soon This Space Will Be Too Small by Lasse de Sella. It's, I find it a deeply profound piece of music, especially since she passed away about 5 or 6 years ago from breast cancer, at a very young age, of in her late 30s, after producing 3 really beautiful records. But this one is especially great because she talks about how it's a story that her dad used to tell her about how when we're in the womb, we think that that's like the whole world and that's everything that there is and nothing could ever be different. And then the birth happens and it's so violent and messy and bloody, and we think as we're being born that this must be death, this must be what it's like to die. And then we are born and we're in the world, and we think that this is all there is to it. And she says, soon this space will be too small and I'll go outside to the huge hillside, you know. And so it's this beautiful idea that all we know now is what we know now, but maybe our death will be a birth into something even more beautiful, you know. So I find that quite consoling.
Will be burned to dust. You apart, and my dust will tell what my flesh would not. Soon the space will be too small, and I'll go outside, and I'll go outside.
Justin, we've talked around the subject of death in a very philosophical way,
yeah.
But death has a very visceral
yeah.
materiality.
Sure. Yeah.
So, like, have you given any thought to what might happen in terms of your own funeral ritual, where it might happen,
yeah.
who might be there, who might lead it, how many stages it might have, you know, all those kind of practical things?
Yeah, I haven't given that much thought, but it's a difficult one to think about because we're not ever sure when we're going to die. So I suppose to me the most important thing is not so much like whether it be in a church or in a or you know one of these so-called official holy places, but to me, you know, to me all of religion and all of art and all of these things are all about human connection. It's like my professor Douglas Davies, you say, religion is all about bodies, embodiment. So to me, you know, I mean, you know, I'd just like all of my, obviously my family and the people closest to me and my friends to gather together and connect with each other. That would be the most important thing to me wherever it happens. It might just happen down at the beach, or it might, I mean, when Alison and I got married, we got married in the park. Just near where we lived, but we just invited all our friends to come and bring some food and come and connect with us. It cost us hardly anything, you know. But it was really special, and people still remember it as a really special time because there wasn't anything to sort of get in the way. There wasn't anything to filter through the human connection.
Mm.
It was just about bodies getting together. So that would be really important to me, that people come and they connect and they don't just sit.
But we're still left with the matter of a body.
Yeah, we do
and
have
what
a body.
Is it going to be, I mean, cremated or
I mean,
is it going to be buried?
I do feel that I do love the idea of a woodland burial site because nature and trees and stuff is really important to me and part of my life. And I'd love to feel that I became, physically anyway, compost and give life another chance. Maybe it would be an elm tree coming back or something, or having another chance to live. So yeah, I'd love to, if it was possible to be buried. People have a wicker coffin, don't they? And they are buried in a human, in a woodland burial site.
You could be buried in a shroud, an eiderdown.
Right.
You know, anything
yeah.
as long as it's not polluting.
So I do like that idea. I like the idea of going back to the soil. And I think, you know, some of these, I mean, like Lasse's song that we just heard, Arvo Pärt's song, I'd love it if my colleagues and my friends would perform. Recorded music's really important, and I do so much work with it, but to me, music is for being played. I mean, Lasse's one is so a snapshot of her before she died that could very well be played on a record. But, you know, I'd love my friends to come and play. I mean, I have so many colleagues and people that are special to me. I'd love it if they would sing and play. I'd love it if, you know, Camilla would sing Arvo Pärt and Katie would play the organ.
And you know, Ari would play the drums?
Ari would be on the drums, yeah, he would indeed. Maybe on the last piece. Yeah, so that would be special.
It's interesting, though, the idea of a woodland burial site means that there'll be no physical marker in the sense
yeah,
of a gravestone
sure.
or something like that.
Yeah.
So would you see that your work is your legacy?
I definitely think so. I mean, when I was younger, remember when I was in my 20s, early 20s, and I rented this room in an old farmhouse in Melbourne, Australia, and I set up all my equipment and my mics and stuff, and I was working on a record. And I remember one night, late at night, about 1 a.m, sort of switching off the mics and shutting the laptop, pressing save, you know, and shutting the laptop, and then climbing into bed, and then thinking, suddenly the thought of mortality came upon me, and I thought, I could die tonight in my bed. And I felt a great solace that even if I did die that night, my friends would come in the morning and they'd be able to open the laptop and listen to what I'd done, and it might last longer than my own life, you know. So I suppose in one aspect, that's the great thing about writing music, is that, or writing books, or leaving behind some sort of something that people can hear or perform, even take on. I mean, I just still think it's amazing that we play, you know, Bach now, you know, 300 years later, we still have it so perfectly annotated in his own hand. And yet would tapes or records or CDs still exist in 300 years? Who knows? But we're able to still perform his work, and that's an amazing thing that he's given us. We should have Bach next. Johann Sebastian Bach is probably my hero, and we don't really know much about him as a person. He had quite a sort of stressful and difficult life. He was never really that successful in his own life, but now he's thought of as probably the greatest composer of music that we know. So there's loads of Bach that I've played all over through my life. I still play Bach every day as a sort of way of doing yoga on my violin, the unaccompanied suites, to try and warm up my brain, my spirit. But this one's particularly beautiful, and I think has such a beautiful sort of heart to it. It's from the St. Matthew Passion, and it's sort of about two-thirds towards the end, just as the crowd, he has the rabble of the crowd in the choir, are sort of almost screaming with this very dissonance, "Crucify him," to Christ. Suddenly, sort of time evaporates, and you hear these two oboes pulsing, and this almost achingly beautiful flute melody, and then the soprano crossing in over the top of it, singing Aus Liebe, which is, out of love did my Saviour come and do this, you know. So he almost lifts you out of the violence of what's happening. I mean, and that's so much around us now. And for about 2 minutes, you're almost in heaven and you've got love. And then suddenly at the end of it, you're thrown back into the rabble. And it's just one of the most transcendent moments in music, I find. So I'd love to have that. Thank you.
That back piece is really beautiful. But what will the rest of your funeral sound like, Justin?
I thought about this a lot because they are quite spacious and sort of melancholic pieces. But I would like to leave some of my own voice behind, like we were just talking about. So there's two things I'd like to have in there. One is I'd like everyone who comes to make music, because part of, I think, my work at the moment is, especially in the hospitals and with kids, and is trying to empower anybody and everybody to, encounter themselves in music and participate in music, whether or not they think they are musical, which everybody is actually. So I'd love everyone to sing, and I was thinking on the way down that, where I did this thing called Human Orchestra for a few years, where we made up scores that anyone could do, and one of them that was very simple but really always really beautiful was Wonder Wonder, where everyone wanders around the room choosing notes of their choice and singing them and listening to each other, and then when they eventually want to finish, they gather in a central point and hold the note that they're on, and when everyone's there, then they just at the end of that breath finish. And it's always, every time we've done it in arts festivals and community centres, and everyone's always stunned by how beautiful they're able to make music so easily. So I suppose it'd be quite nice to do that, and maybe everyone could wander around and then gather around me or something and finish their song. I'd love to do that. I'd also love to have one of my own recordings played, which is Two Horses, which is the final song on the record I did called The Dissolving, which is, I feel like, the best record I did. There's a lot of life and death in it. Two Horses was about when we lived at Inchidonny Beach and seeing the horses and kind of coming to terms with simplicity and with the natural world, and finding a sort of transcendence in that, or finding a connection in that, and being able to accept mortality through seeing life everywhere happening, you know. So I'd love to have that played.
Trees are growing.
Your life is ever turning, and you are not afraid to die. There's two colors, man. Two colors, man, in the sky. Running across the sand, the white one is ever coming, the black one is in my hand.
Well, Justin, that sounds like a lovely funeral.
Thanks. You're invited.
Thank you. I hope I won't be there. I haven't asked you the really difficult question that I have to ask everyone, and that is, what do you think actually happens to you, Justin Grounds, when you die? Do you think you'll persist in a kind of an afterlife, or have you any views or thoughts or expectations?
It's a constantly evolving thought, and it's one that I don't know if my idea of it really matters, because you know, my whole perspective on God and theology is that it's really an unknowing, and I'm quite happy with the unknowing, and in a way it's a wordless thing. The more I try and put it into words, you know, you just get, it's like a can of worms. And I think there's a certain silence that's really important when approaching these matters. I definitely think that life isn't only what the materialists or the atheists or whatever think is just what, you know, what we have here and now. And I think that because of these experiences I've had of playing music and performing music and these very transcendent, meaningful things. And I think meaningful time and meaningful human connection draws me into an understanding that there is more depth than we see to what's happening and what's happening now. However that manifests itself, I'm happy to take the journey. It could be reincarnation, like Lhasa feels, into a new incarnation, a new body. It could be you know, part of me feels that we are all going to be bound up into this sort of state of consciousness or something, where we don't have to think too much. It's really an unknowing, and I'm happy to embark whenever the time comes. I feel that, you know, if we can love as much as we can now, we'll probably be prepared for it.
And does that lead you to your next song?
Well, this is a song that, you know, when I was compiling this list, we were actually on a trip. I was on a trip with my family, and I met with my sister. We went and I said, "Oh, I'm actually compiling a list of songs for my funeral." She looked at me funny, and I started playing her something. She said, "Oh, I love that Ave Pet one." And then my wife turned to me and she said, "Oh, this stuff's really sad. You're going to have everyone weeping, you know." And she said, "You're not like that, you know." So she said, "You've got to have something kind of funky in there." So I thought, "Yeah, that's true." And you know, like I said earlier, music has the ability to hold happy and sad together. It's one of the only things I've ever found that has the ability to do that. And so I chose Paul Simon's, from his Graceland record, Diamonds on the Soles of Her Shoes. It's a groovy song, has these awesome African vocals in the background. But his lyrics are sort of melancholic too, and they're holding happy and sad together. Song I've loved my whole life. I've loved that record. My mum used to sing me Paul Simon songs when I was a kid, and we actually walked out of our own wedding to this song. So I kind of feel like it would be appropriate to walk out of life too.
She's a rich girl, she don't try to hide it.
diamonds on the soles of his shoes. He's a poor boy, empty as a pocket, empty as a pocket with nothing to lose. Sing ta-na-na, ta-na-na-na. She got diamonds on the soles of her shoes. Ta-na-na, ta-na-na-na. She got diamonds on the soles of her shoes. 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 Say she's crazy, she got diamonds on the soles of her shoes. Well, that's one way to lose these walking blues. Diamonds on the soles of your shoes. She was physically forgotten, but then she slipped into my pocket with my car keys. She said, "You've taken me for granted because I please you. Wearing these diamonds. And I could say, ooh, as if everybody knows what I'm talking about. As if everybody here would know exactly what I was talking about. I'm talking about diamonds on the soles of her shoes. Changes clothes and he puts on aftershave to compensate for his ordinary shoes. And she said, "Honey, take me dancing," but they ended up by sleeping in a doorway by the bodegas and the lights on over Broadway, wearing diamonds on the soles of their shoes. And I could say, ooh. Everybody you would know what I was talking about. I mean, everybody you would know exactly what I was talking about. I'm talking about soles of my shoes, yeah. Well, that's one way to lose these walking blues. Diamonds on the soles of my shoes. Thank you.
You've been listening to Endnotes with me, Sheila Broderick. We are currently recording interviews for this series. If you have views you would like to share about death, dying, funerals, the afterlife, and would like to share your own funeral playlist, please get in touch. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Clonline Radio and the web at clonlineradio.com, where you can also find podcasts of previous shows. Thanks for listening.